I have to deal with that. No matter what you do will never be enough, I guarantee you. No matter what somebody else does, if you have that hole, they can't fill it because it doesn't get filled like that. Doesn't get resolved in that way. And I love the word resolved. If you break it down, to resolve the problem, right? To resolve the problem. That's what we mean when we resolve. Yep.
So Dr. Whitfield yesterday made the comment in his presentation in the morning that we have three basic instincts for survival. So this is very connected here. We have three basic instincts: fight, flight, freeze. Fight, attack, flight, run, freeze, hide, or camouflage. So we're talking about a survival instinct here. At the very basic level, most of the stuff that Alan's talking about is described in the psychology terminology as ego defense mechanisms. We're defending our ego. That's not a bad thing. The unhealthy part of it is that we're defending an ego that doesn't exist. But we don't know that. And we don't know that we don't know. And we can't see that we don't see. And we really do believe that the self we're protecting is the real self. I've come across those Russian dolls that are encased in one another. They're all an exact replica of one another. The big one, you reach inside and there's a smaller one, and then you reach inside, there's a smaller one. And I see that's who we are. And we don't know that's who we are. We have this real self that Alan's talking about, but because of genetics, family influence, culture, education, and experience, we have a conditioned response that we don't know is a conditioned response, and we have a Hollywood storefront self, a persona, a mask. Alan uses the word the fabricated self that we've built. But we don't know that we built it because we built it incrementally over our life, and it is what we believe who we are. And the whole point of how Alan started in terms of the pause is in fact to connect from our executive functioning to connect with, is this reality that I'm dealing with? That's why that serenity prayer that we talk about is the deep wisdom prayer. I don't know what reality is normally. I see reality as I am, not as it is. And the whole point of emotional sobriety is to begin to unpack it so that we actually see that true self, that inner core of goodness. I think the Buddhists call it the original face. Thanks.
So Fritz goes on to say that our dependency makes slaves out of us. That's emotional dependency, right? Our emotional dependency makes slaves out of us, especially if its dependency is a dependency of our self-esteem. If you need encouragement, praise, pats on the back from everybody, then you make everybody your judge. So where did the emotional center of gravity go? From inside to outside. You see that? So pay attention to that. Keep asking yourself, where's Waldo? No, where's the emotional center of gravity? Where's the emotional center of gravity? So this is an important idea to understand this stuff too, and I'm not going to go at this in too much length because we could spend a whole day on differentiation, but this is Dr. Murray Bowen. He was a psychiatrist. He did a lot of work with families, and he approached his psychiatric work from a very, very different position. Instead of following the psychoanalytic ideas, he said, I'm going to apply more of an evolutionary paradigm to understanding how people grow and what happens. And so he said, if we look at the basic structure of life that influences all life, we see we have to look at the development of a cell. And when a cell starts out, it's undifferentiated. So what does that mean? Well, it means that the DNA inside the cell has not expressed itself. So it hasn't turned on certain genes and turned off other genes. When it does that, the cell becomes specialized, and it has a very specific function in your body that it carries out. So if I was able to go inside a womb of a mother and take that cell that was going to become a part of the child's eye and replant it on the cheek of the child, if that cell is undifferentiated, it does a very interesting thing. And this is the idea behind all that interest in stem cells. That cell will now pick up the programming from the cells around it, the DNA programming, and change its nature. And it will become part of the cheek. But if I move that cell after it's differentiated, what happens? A third eye grows on the cheek. Fascinating. Well, he said, that's not only how cells grow, that's how people grow. You come into this world pretty much undifferentiated. You're like an acorn. You need certain things to unfold and to become the oak tree you're going to be. There are certain conditions that have to be met. None of us have those met. So then we start to change our development and get overly influenced. So he said differentiation goes across a scale of undifferentiation to high differentiation. Well, what does that mean in terms of family and in terms of our behavior? Well, if we're well differentiated, then what happens is we learn to balance these two important desires that we have and almost every species on this planet has to one degree or another, especially if you're a mammal. It's the desire to cooperate, the union side of the equation, with the individuality desire to be true to one's true self or to hold on to yourself, to keep your individuality. If your family had a high level of differentiation, then these are the conditions that you would grow to. You'd learn how to be connected but not lose yourself. You follow me? The less differentiation that occurred in your family, so the more dysfunctional your family was, the lower the differentiation is. The lower the differentiation is, the more you fall out of one side of this bed or the other. Either you focus on completely pleasing other people to be okay and forget yourself, we call that the self-effacing solution, or you focus so much on yourself you forget others, the narcissistic solution. Right? You see that? You fall out of one side of the bed or the other. If you're well differentiated, then you can stay connected and keep a sense of yourself. This shows up in all different kinds of theories. Dr. Eric Fromm, who wrote The Art of Loving, talks about mature love as union with the preservation of integrity. Union with the preservation of integrity. I connect with you, but I don't lose myself. Very important. Now, what happens if there's low differentiation? Well, these are some of the issues. You don't know how to regulate yourself. You end up taking things personally. Your self-esteem is other validated. You have this reflected sense of self. Your boundaries suck. You take responsibility for things you're not responsible for. Don't take responsibility for what you are responsible for. You end up feeling depressed, angry, and anxious. Well, how many of us can identify with that? Most of us, right? I mean, come on. There's an ACA convention. If you don't feel that, then you don't belong in this room. Kimberly, watch the hands again. No. What's that? I have to go back and take too much time to do that. You'll get these slides. Send me that email. Okay. So this is what happens with low differentiation. We now demand reassurance all the time. So trying to reassure someone who demands reassurance reinforces the myth that more closeness, more union is needed for them to feel okay. You see what I mean? That if somebody's insecure and they're saying, I need you to do this for me to feel better, and you go along with that, you are not helping them. You aren't enabling them. Because you're preventing them from growing up and learning how to do what? stand on their own two feet and take care of their own feelings. High differentiation, when people achieve it, looks very different. You maintain a solid and flexible sense of yourself. You're thoughtful and reflective. You live in that space between the stimulus and the response. Shoulds are non-existent. You don't operate from shoulds. You don't should on yourself, and you don't should on anybody else. You don't take things personally. Your relationship becomes I to you, or I to thou, as Martin Buber described it. When you're undifferentiated, relationships are it to it. I'm an object that needs to be approved of and validated, and you're the object I'm going to get that approval and validation from. And then we wonder why the relationship goes down the tubes. Of course it does, because it's not personal. When you have an I to thou relationship, you're in it and you're seeing the other person. And you don't treat them as though they're there to meet your needs. You enjoy them, and they enjoy you. That's what an I-to-thou relationship is. We say there's room enough for two people, right? So you don't have to live up to my expectations. I don't have to live up to yours. That's what a healthy relationship looks like. We call it room enough for two. It's real big and roomy. And there's no rules other than the rules that, you know, you do and, you know, you be yourself in whatever way you need to be yourself, and you follow what's important to you, and I'll do the same. And hopefully we'll be able to join and build a life together. If not, it can't be helped. But we don't try to put a square peg in a round hole. Right? This is Byron Katie, and she talks about it only takes one clear person to have a good relationship. It only takes one person raising their differentiation, because when you raise your differentiation, then the people around you have to raise their differentiation too if they're going to stay connected to you. If not, then it's not, can't be helped, right? Takes one clear person. So you don't need to worry about changing them. You got to differentiate yourself. You got to grow yourself. And we'll talk about how relationships are great people growers a little bit later. So now we get into the meat of what this talk was about. But I wanted to lay that out to you guys so you guys got a sense of where we're going with this, right? And understanding in terms of what this whole issue is about emotional sobriety. So this letter was written in 1956. It was actually first appeared in the 1958 Grapevine. I believe it was in the summer issue, June issue maybe. And what this letter was about is somebody wrote in to the General Service Office in New York, and Bill was at that time answering almost all the correspondence, and somebody wrote in and said, and it was a guy out here in California, and I haven't been able to identify who it is yet. He says, look, I am been terribly depressed, and I'm trying to figure out how these steps can help me deal with my depression. I keep trying to plug them in, and I keep failing. And I'm tired of it, and can you share with me any ideas that might help me? Now, 1956, Bill got sober in 35. Do the math, 21 years, right? He's on his journey for 21 years. A few years ago, he wrote the 12 and 12. Now, think of the 12 and 12 as a map. In fact, Herb and I are going to be doing a workshop in Westlake on the 12 steps in emotional sobriety, coming up in about 3 months. And if you're on my mailing list or his, you'll be able to get a flyer about that. But the 12 and 12 is all about establishing emotional sobriety if you read it. And we'll be able to unpack that when we do this workshop in June or sometime. So 21 years in admission, Bill struggled with depression a lot. He was a really seeker of truth about himself and how he could deal with his feelings in a better way so he didn't have to go back to drinking. He was in stage two recovery, right? He was really looking at the causes and conditions that were causing his depression. And so this letter is a synopsis of what he had learned over these 21 years of struggling with that issue. I call this the fourth legacy that Bill has left us in recovery. First being the steps, Bill and Bob. second being the traditions, the third being the general service, and the fourth being this issue on emotional sobriety. Kimberly, I think you have part of this as your packet. It was printed out, the letter. So this is a very important piece of information. So let's dig into this letter. What is that? That's a fire alarm. I didn't do that. So we need to find out if we actually have to clear out the building.
Oh, it might be a false alarm. It's off now.
Or it might be a warning. Inhale. Exhale. All right. She's calming down our central nervous system. We all went into a fight or flight response. That may not have been coincidental. That alarm went off warning you. Warning you about what's going to happen next.
That's right.
All right, so let's go back to this slide and replay it so that you guys can get the audio on it. This will be have the one that with the audio. It's there, but it's not coming up.
Still find that they often lack emotional sobriety.
Yeah, we'll fix that.
Perhaps they will be the spearhead for the
we had it fixed earlier. Do you need to turn up the volume on my laptop, or you got a cord that's not?
Which is to say, humility in our relations with ourselves.
You changed over. Remember, you went to the different one?
And with God.
Yeah, but you used a different cord. Is that the one you're on? You used the... Let's try.
I think many oldsters who have put our booze cure to severe but successful tests still find that they often lack emotional sobriety. Perhaps they will be the spearhead for the next major development in AA, the development of much more real maturity and balance, which is to say, humility, in our relations with ourselves, with our fellows, and with God.
Well, this is the first place that I could find, other than I think it appears in the 12 and 12, Bill talking about emotional sobriety. And he defined it as real maturity and balance, right? So go back to that concept I talked about, the emotional center of gravity, right? That's what creates our balance in relation to ourselves, with our fellows, and with the God of our understanding. So this becomes very important, is how do we stay balanced in all of those relationships? It's hard to stay balanced if you have a lot of shoulds about how you're supposed to behave because you're constantly judging yourself. If you're dependent on others and you move your emotional center of gravity out there, it's hard to stay balanced in relationships because they're in charge of how you're going to feel. You see that? And Herb is going to speak about if you do the same thing with God, that's not going to work, right?
I found that my concept of God was the very impediment to my relationship with the mystery. My concept got in the way of the reality.
Well, we lost the audio again.
And perfect romance.
Let me go back.
Those adolescent urges that so many of us have for top approval, perfect security, and perfect romance, urges quite appropriate to age 17, prove to be an impossible way of life when we are at age 47 or 57.
Okay, those adolescent urges, right? We're very idealized when we're adolescents. Top approval, we want everybody to like us. Perfect security, I'm never going to get depressed. I'm never going to get upset. I'm never going to feel anxious. I'm always going to feel calm. I'm always going to know what to do. I'm never going to be confused. Right? Perfect security. Perfect romance? My partner will always do what I want them to do. That's how we define it. My partner's going to always do what I want them to do. If you know, we'll have a great relationship if you just do what I want you to do. That's the message, the unenforceable rule that we have. This proves to be an impossible way of life. Why is it impossible? Because where's our center of emotional gravity? Outside of yourself. If you put that emotional center of gravity outside yourself, you lose the ability to be the determining force in your own life. And now you're on the ocean and you're going to bob and weave depending on the conditions of the sea. All right? When you have emotional sobriety, you got a rudder. You're able to direct your course. You're able to deal with whatever conditions you're facing. So this becomes a very, very important insight that Bill had.
Since AA began, I've taken immense wallops in all those areas because of my failure to grow up emotionally and spiritually. My God, how painful it is to keep demanding the impossible, and how very painful to discover, finally, that all along we had the cart before the horse. Then comes the final agony of seeing how awfully wrong we have been, but still finding ourselves unable to get off the emotional merry-go-round.
This is what I love about Bill. He's talking about what Fred Holmquist from the Lodge at Hazleton calls sober suffering. Sober suffering. You're no longer drinking or using or doing whatever you do, but still life isn't working in the way you hoped it would work. He talks about his failure to grow up emotionally and spiritually, that he was demanding the impossible, which means what? That the life somehow takes care of his needs. And that we had the cart before the horse, because when I'm focused on what you're not doing to make me feel better, I'm not focusing on what I need to do to feel better.
But it's not our fault. It's the way we're conditioned. And again, we don't see that we don't see. The demanding of the impossible is just that instinct of survival dealing with reality as we define reality. And Alan said, the should defines who I am. It defines who you are. And it defines how the world works. If you really want to understand what you believe, hear yourself say should out loud or just quietly in your head. I should, you should, the world should. That describes your belief. Then you can look at it and say, is this healthy? Is this real or not? An unexamined should will have this sense of frustration and suffering. And Chuck C. in AA had a book written about a talk that he gave called A New Pair of Glasses. That's the whole point of therapy. That's the whole point of 12-step process and methodology, is in fact to have that breakthrough where we see the outcome of the false self, our suffering, and begin the deconstruction of that false self. And rebuilding or reconnecting to, or connecting for the first time, to our true self.
How to translate a right mental conviction into a right emotional result, and so into easy, happy, and good living? Well, that's not only the neurotic's problem. It's the problem of life itself for all of us who have got to the point of real willingness to hew to right principles in all of our affairs.
So what he's saying here is that he realized that you can understand something intellectually, but if you don't also get it emotionally, which what we call integrate that knowledge, then it's not available for you. So you can get these ideas all day long, but as long as they remain ideas, they're not going to be useful. That somehow you have to integrate this. You have to go through a process that now helps you work through whatever is blocking you from being able to embrace this knowledge, this wisdom.
The man who helped me break through is standing right there in terms of he was my therapist at one point, and another man in the 12-step room. This other man said to me after we had a conversation about my background and I was asking him for help, he did this. You have to look at me for this. He said, "Herb, you have a lot of information. But you have no transformation. You have knowledge from all the wonderful work that you've done, but you've never connected it to your experience or your heart." I knew he knew that I didn't know.
Isn't that a great graphic? This is the live PowerPoint over here. You know, guys don't see it, but I got a little controller. I press it, he stands up. We got it programmed in him to say that. It's wonderful. No, but isn't it great how he bounces off me with these things? Don't you love that? I love it. She says, "Is that the neck up, head down?" I wasn't here yesterday, so I imagine so. I imagine that that concept is very similar to what that was talking about.
"Even then, as we hew away, peace and joy may still elude us. That's the place so many AA oldsters have come to. And it's a hell of a spot, literally. How shall our unconscious, from which so many of our fears, compulsions, and phony aspirations still stream, be brought into line with what we actually believe, know, and want? How to convince our dumb, raging, and hidden Mr. Hyde becomes our main task."
Wow. So now you can start to see some of the therapy that Bill did. He talks about his unconscious, right? Freud said we are being lived by the forces within us. Big part of psychoanalytic therapy is to make what's unconscious conscious, we talk about. So what does he say is going on? In the unconscious are these fears, right? That I'm not going to belong, I'm not going to be loved, I'm not going to be accepted. And what happens is they create these compulsions, meaning that I have to be someone I'm not to be okay. So we develop that false self, that fabricated self, the engineered self, whatever you want to call it. And the phony aspiration is that somehow I'm going to be perfect. And once I pull this off perfectly, I'm going to be okay. See, that's that appeal, whatever direction we're heading in. Once I get everybody to love me, I'm going to be fine. Once I master everything, I'm going to be okay. Once I have complete freedom and I'm not tied into any reaction to you, then I'm going to be okay. But you're never going to be okay going down those paths. So he calls those the phony aspirations, those different appeals. How can they be brought into line with what I would say reality? We know that mental health is when you're in touch with yourself and you're in touch with reality. You have to have both of those things to function well. You can't have one or the other. If you just focus on what's going on in reality, you're going to be what? Off balance. If you're just focusing on yourself, you're going to be what? Out of touch with the other. You have to be able to hold both at the same time to function well. And that's what Bill's insight is here. Now, the dumb and raging hidden Mr. Hyde is that part that wants everybody to follow our unenforceable rules. And we don't want anybody to know we have that dumb and raging Mr. or Mrs. Hyde, because there's plenty of Mrs. Hydes out there, not just Mr. Hydes, right?
"I've recently come to believe that this can be achieved. I believe so, because I begin to see many benighted ones, folks like you and me, commencing to get results. Last autumn, depression, having no really rational cause at all, almost took me to the cleaners. I began to be scared that I was in for another long chronic spell. Considering the grief I've had with depressions, it wasn't a bright prospect. I kept asking myself, why can't the 12 steps work to release depression? By the hour, I stared at the St. Francis prayer. It's better to comfort than to be comforted. Here was the formula, all right. But why didn't it work?
So put a bookmark there. We're going to come back and talk about that later. If I forget to, remind me.
Suddenly, I realized what the matter was. My basic flaw had always been dependence, almost absolute dependence, on people or circumstances to supply me with prestige, security, and the like. Failing to get these things according to my perfectionist dreams and specifications, I had fought for them. And when defeat came, so did my depression.
So, he's finally answered the question. What are the causes and conditions that are creating my depression? And when he looked at himself, he realized that his basic flaw, because when you start to look at the inventory, we're asked to identify our basic flaws. What are they? Well, his basic flaw had been dependence. He called it absolute dependence. I'd call it emotional dependency. On people or circumstances to supply him with prestige, security, and the like. Where was his emotional center of gravity? Way outside of himself. How did he respond? He had the appeal of mastery, right? That he would control things, that he would set things up, and he would be on top, and that people would follow his thing. He says, when things didn't go his way, according to his perfectionist dreams and specifications, because you got to remember, is as soon as you launch yourself in one of those directions, that becomes an absolute. So things must be that way. So when things must be that way, it means you have absolute thinking, which creates what? Black and white thinking. It's either okay or not okay. Either things are right or they're not right. There's no gray anymore in your life. Is there a quick question?
Yes. Are you talking about the difference between external locus of control and internal?
In psychology, it's defined very differently when you get into the locus of control, but it's related. It's related, but there are some differences, and I don't want to speak too much about it, because I like it better if you think of it as, where is your emotional center of gravity? Because people that have an internal locus of control can still be dependent on others to be okay. Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because it's a different concept, and at some other point we could talk about it, but that's not something we can go into here. Now, I just wanted to say this. So when defeat came, so did his depression. So he meant that as soon as he tried to get things to go his way and tried to control other people, get Lois to do what he wanted her to do, and she didn't go along with it because she said, maybe that worked before, Bill, but it's not going to work now. We're in recovery. And Bill goes, oh, my God, this woman has differentiated. He didn't say that because he didn't know the concept. But if he knew the concept, he'd say, God, Lois, why are you growing up? Right? I liked it better when I could just get my way all the time. Right? This is the dance that goes on in relationships, right? That's what Byron Katie said. A relationship can change once one person gets clear. So when she says, no way, Bill, I'm not going along with that nonsense, Bill's going to try to manipulate her, force her to do what he wants. She holds her ground. Now Bill is deflated. He gets depressed. And that's important because now that becomes his personal crucible and he can get to work on trying to figure out what's going on here. And that creates something like this. So this shows us it's so important not to run away from ourselves and our feelings, because if you lean into them, you can grow. You can grow yourself once you understand that when you're upset, and this Bill says it in this step 10, it's a spiritual axiom that every time you're upset, there's something wrong with you. not with the other person. So their message is constantly get that emotional center of gravity back into yourself. Don't keep it out there. Go ahead, Herb.
See, that's the beginning here is the word I realized. He began to wake up. He began to see that what he was doing wasn't working. Byron Katie in Loving What Is says, reality is reality, but only 100% of the time. And we all have a script about who I am, who they are, how the world works. We don't know that we have a script because we actually believe this. This is the delusion. This is the lie of the false self. And Alan nailed it in the sense of what Bill Wilson says in the 12 and 12. And I hate it. It's a spiritual axiom. Whenever I'm disturbed, there is something wrong with me. Notice, this is what Bill is doing. He's not blaming anything outside of himself. He's taking personal responsibility and looking at, so what's going on with me that's creating this suffering?
Well, you just reminded me of a thought I had when you shared before about the difference between blame and responsibility. You know, the question becomes, how do you know if you're taking responsibility or if you're blaming yourself? If you're blaming yourself, you're going to be disempowered and you're going to feel worse. As soon as you take responsibility, you become empowered. So blaming subtracts from you, taking responsibility adds to who you are. See the difference? And we confuse that because a lot of times in our culture, we've taught that if you do something wrong, you beat yourself up. That's a way of taking responsibility, right? Spare the rod, spoil the child. The good Judeo-Christian way, right? You screw up, you're going to have a price to pay for it, right? And I'm going to get you in line by having you pay that price. Nonsense. It's bullshit. You know, you don't grow that way. You grow by learning from your mistake, and you don't learn well when you're beating yourself up.
Alan used a term that I want to highlight, underline, because it's really critical. Unenforceable rules. That's the should. Yeah. It's unenforceable. Again, we don't know that. And we are mystified by why people aren't operating according to our script. But they're unenforceable rules.
God, just think what a should police would look like. I mean, mine would be ugly and scary. Talk about monsters, right? It would be terrible.
There's a question there, maybe?
Oh, we'll come
there
back.
There wasn't
one second.
A chance Wait, of making the outgoing love of St. Francis a workable and joyous way of life until these fatal and almost absolute dependencies were cut away. Because I had over the years undergone a little spiritual development, the absolute quality of these frightful dependencies had never before been so starkly revealed.
So, Bill highlights here that these things are fatal, right? Meaning that they're going to destroy your life. And they really are. Unless you start to take a look at your emotional dependency and start to deal with it, it's going to ruin everything that it touches. There's no question about it. What was your question?
My question is, can you give us more words for wrong? Because a lot of us ACAs grew up with you're wrong. And so when I read that in his letter, it's hard to unpack it from the childhood being told you're wrong.
So where's the, she said, can you use another word for wrong? So the wrong being, where do you get confused about it for yourself when you say that? What's confusing?
Wrong is that there's something inherently flawed or bad about who I am.
Right. So a big important question is to ask yourself, what part of you takes it like that? And instead of getting more words, see, it's finding different parts of yourself. Because see, what you're doing is you're dependent on the environment again. Give me a different word. You see how she did it? This is so darn subtle. It seems like a reasonable question, doesn't it? Well, can you just reframe it for me so I can understand it? No, I won't. See, you got to grow up and find something. See, here's the therapy starts. I can't stop doing this stuff. Oh, my goodness. See if there's a part of you that you can get in touch with that can take that in a different way. You got it. You see what I mean? What part of you would that be?
The innocent.
The innocent? Okay, that's one. Maybe the adult would be able to say, look, we're not talking about that. We're talking about this. You see what I mean? Watch who's listening. You know, when his thing said adult child on board before, I was going to say, I want to talk to your adult. Because if I talk to your child, you're going to run out of here. Because your child wants to control everything. Right? Do this, do that, do that right now, please, quick. I got a 3-year-old in my life. Oh, my God. Talk about directing things. Daddy, go here. Do that. Put on that dress. Do that. Do this, right? Oh, because that she's learning how to deal with, right, life and people and stuff like that. And I'm trying to frustrate her so she grows up.
And she will need therapy.
And then she'll need therapy.
Reinforced by what grace I could secure in prayer, I found I had to exert every ounce of will and action to cut off these faulty emotional dependencies upon people, upon AA, indeed upon any act or circumstance whatsoever. Then could I be free to love as Francis did. Emotional and instinctual satisfactions I saw were really the extra dividends of having love, offering love, and expressing love appropriate to each relation of life.
Wow. So look at this. This surprises a lot of people, but it's going to make sense based on what we've been talking about. He says he had to exert every ounce of will and action to cut off his faulty emotional dependencies. Makes sense. But then when he comes to talking about cutting it off on AA, interesting, huh? Like when I first came to the program, I was told, you know, you're going to change one unhealthy dependency, your dependency on drugs, including alcohol, for a healthier dependency on AA. And I bought it at that time. But what he is saying is the wisdom in Bill's word is that the program is to grow you to take care of yourself. The program is about growing you towards emotional sobriety. And you can't have emotional sobriety if you take that emotional center of gravity and put it in AA. Because when you do that and you're dependent on, what happens if your sponsor doesn't return your phone call? Huh? What do you feel? Huh? Well, that person's not working a very good program, are they? Instead of saying, boy, now I got a chance to stand on my own 2 feet here. How do I figure this out? All right? Anybody wants to and wonder about that, they'll talk to Mary later on. She'll tell them how to figure that out from now on. But you see what I mean? Or that meeting. My God, that meeting's terrible. I'm not going back to those stupid 12-step groups. There was no compassion in that room. Well, instead of worrying about what they're doing, how about you figuring a way to bring more compassion to the room? Instead of being dependent on what they're doing. You see what I mean? It's bringing that back. And that's what Bill started to realize. I cannot depend on AA to do that for me. I have to. Do you start seeing the passivity that emotional dependency creates? Do you see? It's horrible. This passivity, a new book with Hazelton, 12 More Stupid Things. First one I wrote was 12 Stupid Things. That became very popular. And now we're doing 12 More Stupid Things. And I'm glad that one of the themes in that book is dealing with this passivity in our recovery. And finding a way to finally take some responsibility, learn how to stand on our feet in so many different ways.
Last year I read Melody Beattie's book, Codependent No More. And I'd read it 30 years ago, but I was just getting sober and didn't make that much sense, but it certainly did now. And she has 4 levels of this dependency that she talks about. And she introduced me to a new word you may be familiar with. But she says we start out dependent, of course, like on the addiction, whatever that is, addiction du jour, all right? Then we become independent. Then we become interdependent. We become socialized. Then she said we become undependent. That was the new word. I thought, that captures it. What I believe Alan's talking about also.
I am looking for Kimberly to get some direction. I was supposed to end at 10:30. It's 10:30, right? Is that, can I keep going? You guys okay with that? Okay. My God, I want to follow the rules. If I don't follow the rules. I've heard what happens at these ACA conventions when people don't follow the rules. So let's look at this free to love, right? This is a very important part. Because what he's saying is once I get centered in myself, that I've got 15 minutes. Thank you. You're going to give me 15 more. Thank you, Kimberly. I was wondering. Okay, what he's saying here is this free to love, he says, then I can have love, offer love, and express love appropriate to each relation of life. You see, once I give up that idea that everybody's got to like me, I don't have to like everybody. Do you see that? But I got to give up that idea. And now I can have a relationship with you. It doesn't take away from it. It is just what it is. But if it's going to be more meaningful, I can have that more meaningful relationship with someone else that I'm connected to in a different way, instead of having this idea somehow I got to treat everybody the same. I'm not the same. Some days I want to eat chicken. Some days I want to eat beef. Right? There's something that flows inside of me that if I pay attention to, I can connect with one person in one way and that can be fine, and somebody else in another way. But there's no room for that when you have rules. You follow me? Now you're compulsive and you have to function just one way. In psychology, we say your behavior becomes fixed. When your behavior becomes fixed, it's rigid. And rigidity isn't going to work well in terms of your life. It's just not going to help you be the person you want to be. Well, broken clock has the right time twice a day. But hopefully that's not enough for you, right? You don't want to just be okay twice a day. You want to find a way to live where you're okay regardless of what's going on. That's what we're all striving for here. And that's what his insight starts to get towards. Pretty phenomenal, isn't it? How insightful this thing is.
Plainly, I could not avail myself to God's love until I was able to offer it back to him by loving others as he would have me. And I couldn't possibly do that so long as I was victimized by false dependencies. For my dependencies meant demand, a demand for the possession and control of the people and the conditions surrounding me. While those words, absolute dependence, may look like a gimmick, they were the ones that helped to trigger my release into my present degree of stability and quietness of mind, qualities which I am now trying to consolidate by offering love to others, regardless of the return to me.
So my dependency meant a demand for the possession and control of the people and conditions surrounding me. You see, even if you're a people pleaser, you're trying to control other people by getting them like you, by being a people pleaser. So it doesn't matter if you manipulate from what we call a top dog position or an underdog. We're still all manipulating. We're constantly manipulating. So it's not a question, are you manipulating? It's how are you manipulating? Because everybody's doing it. Everybody's doing it. Now, when we grow along these lines, then we use those manipulations in service of a higher self and of an eye-to-thou relationship. Right, where there's room for the other person. So all of those things can be turned around in a good way. There's nothing wrong with pleasing somebody if you're also paying attention to whether you want to do it or not. And if you don't want to do it, that you don't do it unless you can make it I want to. Because if not, then it becomes compulsive again. You guys see that? This becomes so important. Is that you've got to find a way to include yourself in your life in a different way than you did before. That's what Ernie said. Nothing changes, nothing changes.
Isn't that the real definition of the helpless God?
Is the definition of the what?
The helpless God.
The helpless God? I refer all questions of God to Herb Kagan.
Well, to a very large extent, and I wrote a paper on it, God is powerless in that way, because there's only one attribute. If, in fact, this reality exists, this mystery, this it with a capital I, if it exists, then it is powerless if we have free will. Oh, you have a choice, and the whole point about yes. waking up is to see that actually you have a choice, and you made a choice.
No, but you're right on when you say that. You can manipulate in a lot of different ways, and yeah. we'll do that. Look, if my first thing is to control you, and that doesn't work, then I can try to please you to get you to do what I want. Right? I mean, we're very flexible in that, you know. What we want to do is be flexible in a healthier way, where I don't have to worry about manipulating you. I've got to find a way to stand on my own 2 feet.
And the whole point of Bill's reference to the St. Francis prayer is that it captures the spirit of the 12 steps of true, authentic spirituality and actually of true human development, that is the turning from self-centeredness to other-centeredness. But it has to be the healthy self that does the turning and maintains the center of gravity. Because
right.
then I can help other people, like the flight attendant says, put on your own mask first, then you can help other people.
Yeah, that's just a great point. Yeah. You know, I got 10 minutes. Let me come back. We can answer some questions when we break, but we've got a hard finish here. So let me get through this, though.
This seems to be the primary healing circuit, an outgoing love of God's creation and His people, by means of which we avail ourselves of His love for us. It's most clear that the real current can't flow until our paralyzing dependencies are broken, and broken at depth. Only then can we possibly have a glimmer of what adult love really is. If we examine every disturbance we have, great or small, we will find at the root of it some unhealthy dependence and its consequent demand. Let us, with God's help, continually surrender these hobbling demands. Then we can be set free to live and love.
So here's
we
the
may then be able to gain emotional sobriety.
So here's the formula that He gives us to start getting free from our emotional dependency. When you're upset, when you're disturbed, whether it's a big deal or not, He says, look at the issue. Do an inventory. You know, you can call it the spot check inventory from step 10, right? Where you're going to sit down and you're going to try to figure out what, first of all, to become aware that you've got an unenforceable rule working here. And your job is to find out what it is. So you write down and you start to unpack it. See if you can identify the demand you have on what they should be doing for you to feel better, and then what the unhealthy dependence is. How is that demand related to my well-being? And then turn it around. So if I say I need, you're supposed to validate me and you're supposed to tell me I did a good job, gets turned around to, I need to be able to support myself and recognize I did a good job. So I need to validate myself instead of looking for you for that validation. So this is the path to grow. In my book, 12 Smart Things, I call it an emotional sobriety inventory. There's a form in the back. If you send me an email, I've updated that form and changed a few things around. I'll be more than glad to share it with you. You'll see it at the end. It's abphd@msn.com. I gave it out earlier, but you'll see it. I'll put up a slide at the end.
Just one quick item. He uses the term healing circuit here. He has one or two sentences about the healing circuit. I took that very seriously as the solution, the conclusion, the formula, and I took it into a series of reflections and meditation, and I've written out the meditation on the healing circuit, unpacking it at some depth, I believe. And back on that table where the water is the healing circuit And you might be interested in having that as a meditation or as a development of what we're doing here.
Of course, I haven't offered you a really new idea, only a gimmick that has started to unhook several of my own hexes at depth. Nowadays, my brain no longer races compulsively in either elation, grandiosity, or depression. I've been given a quiet place in bright sunshine.
Okay, so that's Bill's letter. Give Bill a big round of applause. Brilliant, brilliant letter. I'm not going to take any more questions. I got 5 minutes left, so I want to run through these slides real quick, okay? And then you can grab me afterwards on a break. All right, so let's look at this emotional sobriety and relationships real quick. So we don't have relationships, we take hostages, right? That's exactly what the problem is. It's not possible for me to relate to others intimately and enjoy and allow and enjoy their full expression of themselves if I have not discovered how to do this for myself. See, that's the emotional sobriety. That's the room enough for two that we're talking about. So we end up with all these rules about how people are supposed to be because of our lack of development, our immaturity, our emotional dependency. So here's some of the rules. She says this is, we talk about marital relationships and base them on these rules and impose demands on it that love can never fulfill. If you love me, you won't do anything without me. If you love me, you'll do what I say. If you love me, you'll give me what I want. If you love me, you'll know what I want even before I ask you. I have said that to somebody. God, how immature is that? She goes, these practices soon turn love into a kind of a blackmail. She calls it the clutch. We call it taking hostages. Whatever it is, there's no room for somebody else in that deal, is there? Wonder why, more than half of our relationships end in divorce. So we've got to grow up. So here's some quick tools that I'll try to run through real fast. We're always trying to get out of our emotional jail. Mostly we try by manipulating other people to let us out. That's the bottom line, no matter what way we try to do it. This is so important. If you try to obtain a sense of security and safety by regulating others, the world is never going to be a safe place. I'll tell you, just take that. If you get nothing else out of this, take that home with you. It's not going to be a safe place. It becomes a safe place when you get centered, right? When your emotional center of gravity is over your feet, then you're safe. Ernie says, in relationships, my lot in life changes not when I first demand change in others, but when I take stock in myself, right? It's looking at ourselves. Virginia says it the same way. She just draws a circle, and then she puts herself in the middle and says, what part of my problem are my fears, my ideas, my expectations? But you see the theme, right? We got to take a look at ourselves in terms of what's going on. Dr. Lerner says the same thing. She says responsibility is the ability to observe ourselves and others in interaction and respond to a familiar situation in a new and different way. To experiment. See, try different ways of holding on to yourself. I'll suggest some in a minute. It's not your job to understand me, it's mine. Right? So instead of me demanding that you pay attention to what I'm doing and what I want from you, I need to understand what I want, right? Is it coming out of this emotional dependency thing? All right, so here's some tips on holding on to yourself, and we got to do these. One of the hallmarks of creative intimacy is the absence of shoulds or musts or other demands. I try not to should on myself every day. Really, pay attention. See if you can clean that up. Get rid of them. So as soon as you let go of that everything must be different for you to be okay, now the constructive forces of the real self, of your real self, can grow. That's what recovery is about, is discovering new possibilities. She says it in another way. If you change the steps to the dance that you're doing with someone else, then the dance has to change. You don't have to worry about changing them. So here they are. Support yourself instead of expecting other people to support you. Stop pressuring other people to change to make you feel better. Instead, pressure yourself to change and become more grounded. Accept yourself instead of demanding that other people accept you as you are. Focus on soothing yourself rather than regulating the behavior of others. It is better to comfort than to be comforted. Go back to that Francis prayer, but rethink it. It's better for me to learn how to soothe myself rather than manipulate me into, please make me feel better. Walt said this was my mentor. He says, in order to be more personal in a relationship, you need to stop taking your partner's behavior personally. What I tell people is instead focus on what this is telling you about the person you're interacting with. Get to know them instead of taking it personally. See what this is saying to you about them. Stop letting other people edit your own reality. Stop giving them that permission. Stop making what other people think about you more important than what you know about yourself. This is the speed course in getting well. We must not allow other people's limited perceptions to define us. Let's not allow their limited perceptions to define us. How powerful is that? Love it. Learn from your mistakes. Don't run and hide from them. Stop turning others into your parent needing their validation, approval, or permission. Give up being rescued or saved. Save yourself. Huh? Love that one. Extract from your emotional reactions the unresolved issues in your life and get to work on resolving them. And respect everybody's need to follow their own path, truth, or their own path. And live aware that we are all evolving individuals. I love that bumper sticker. Please be patient with me. God isn't finished with me yet. Own your own projections is an act of integrity. We're going to jump over all of these and get over. When you face trouble, add more self. Don't subtract yourself from the conflict. That's the bottom line here. So thank you very much. I will put my email address up so you can write it down.